The brewing and marketing of ale and beer are largely male enterprises today, as is its consumption, if one's to judge by the images of popular culture. We're about to learn, however, that that has not always been the case. Once upon a time, as they say, brewing was woman's work. And here to tell us more about that and why things changed is Judith Bennett, professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and the author of a great new book, Ale, Beer, and Brewsters in England, Woman's Work in a Changing World, 1300 to 1600, published by Oxford University Press. Welcome, Professor Bennett.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. As the title suggests, this is more than just a history of brewing beer in medieval England. It's a social history as well, but maybe we should start with the first part of your story, and maybe even with the title, the term brewsters. Sounds like brewers, but it isn't quite the same, and it's likely to be unfamiliar to most of us. So what does it mean, and what are the origins of that term?
The ending stirrer is a feminine ending in Middle English, just like today we talk about waitresses and actresses. In Middle English, stir indicated a female occupation, and so a brewster is a female brewer. The terms mostly survive in modern English in surnames, so a Webster is a female weaver, Baxter a female baker, and Brewster a female brewer.
So this suggests the considerable involvement of women then in the brewing of beer.
That's right. In fact, in medieval England, a lot of regulations don't talk about brewers at all. They talk about brewsters, which suggests that in the minds of the mayors and aldermen putting out these regulations, that almost all people in the brewing industry were, in fact, women.
Okay, let's pursue that a bit. In your book, you indicate that at least prior to 1350, the brewing of beer, ale and beer, was largely woman's work, thus the word brewsters. How did that come about and why?
It came about because beer brewing initially was domestic labor. Women brewed it to provide ale for their families to consume. It was a critical part of the English diet. Ale and bread were the two essential parts of the diet. And so women, as good wives, would brew ale for their families to consume. And if they had extra left over, they would sell it to their neighbors. So it began as women's household work, and then slowly, as it became commercialized, it grew out of the household.
Okay, so first ale, beer came a little later, and first in the home for home consumption, and then a bit sold outside the home.
That's right.
Okay, well, what happened after 1350 to change that?
Well, first of all, let me just say that before 1350, if we lived in a village before 1350, almost all women would sometimes sell a little bit of ale out of their houses. So it was a very widespread and dispersed trade. If we lived in a village of 100 households, almost all of them would occasionally have women in them selling ale. After 1350, the trade becomes much more specialized. In say, that village of 100 people, there might just be a half dozen people selling ale. That happens for a whole variety of complex reasons. Obviously, what happens around 1350 is the Great Plague, which sweeps through England 1347-49 and kills perhaps a third of the population, is our best estimate. So there are fewer people in England after 1350, but they drink a lot more ale. The standards of living rise, the diet changes. They drink more ale, they drink better quality ale. They also tend to drink it much more in ale houses as opposed to taking it home, and it's much more profitable to sell ale within ale houses. And so as demand for ale rises, it becomes a more profitable industry, and slowly men become interested in it as well, and slowly they begin to encroach on what had been a women's trade. Mm.
So as it becomes more commercial, it becomes more attractive to men for the possibility of making profit and so on.
That's right. It's a much more profitable trade after 1350 than it had been before.
Did you note any resistance on the part of women to this? Was there any conflict in this changeover between the sexes?
There's absolutely no evidence of resistance on this score, but of course our records are very limited. I think we can't say there was resistance or that there wasn't. The sort of resistance that would have happened would have been, you know, an argument in a street between a brewster and a brewer, that sort of thing. There are no records of something like that.
You note that by 1600, most brewers are male, but earlier you suggest in the 15th century, we find that women are actually doing some brewing but hiding behind their husband's sort of public persona. Why was this the case?
Well, let me just say the withdrawal of women from brewing happens for different sorts of women at different times. So the first women who tend to leave the trade are women who don't have husbands, women who are what we would today probably call spinsters, but were then called single women, women who had never married, begin to leave the trade after 1350, and also widows. So women without full households, in a sense, without husbands and husbands' labor help and capital, leave the trade earlier. Slowly, wives also, as you say, began to hide their trading behind their husbands, and there are a variety of reasons for that. One is that the people who regulated the trade preferred to deal with husbands than with wives, because under the systems of law then in place, men were more legally liable than women. And so if you had a brewing household doing something wrong, it was easier to bring it to account if you could deal with the husband rather than the wife. So it became convenient in terms of regulation and public presentation of the business to have the husband as the responsible person.
Okay. Well, let me take you back to a point you sort of hinted at earlier when you mentioned the plague. When we talk about the brewing of beer here, we're not just simply talking about a tavern drink, although that's certainly part of it, or something for socializing. You make the point in your book that beer is really quite central to the English diet during the Middle Ages. Explain that a bit for us.
I'll have to answer that in two ways. First of all, and we've alluded to this earlier, but I should clarify, there's a distinction in this period between ale and beer. And ale is made without hops. We don't drink anything related to medieval ale now at all. Beer is made with hops. Ale is the earlier drink, and it is absolutely essential to the English diet through the Middle Ages. There are only two commodities, food products that are strictly regulated in the Middle Ages. One is bread, which is very obvious to us as an essential part of the human diet, but the other is ale. And it was regulated because it was the essential liquid refreshment for everyone. Wine was too expensive for anyone but the very wealthy to consume. Milk was mostly made into cheese. And water was usually polluted and considered unhealthy to drink. And so the brewing of ale, which involved boiling water, made it a healthier drink. And everyone drank ale all the time. Children drank it. Old people drank it. They drank it at breakfast, at lunch, and at dinner. I should say that the strengths varied enormously, and so the everyday ale that people drank was not going to make them drunk or lead to inebriation. It was just the standard drink.
Was consumption a class matter, or did we find that upper classes drank beer as well as wine?
Yes, in an elite household, they would actually we have very good dietary accounts for some elite households, and they would drink ale, again, at breakfast, at lunch, at dinner, but also supplement it when they could get it with wine.
And women then would consume their fair share as well as men?
Yes. Oh. And a lot of ale was consumed every day. We have records of the amount of ale that was needed for armies, and we know from that, and also actually we have some records that suggest the average daily consumption in monasteries. And I think it's fair to say that in, say, 1300, the average adult male consumption of ale per day was a gallon of ale.
Hmm.
A lot of ale.
That is, yeah. Well, just for the record, correct my earlier reference, when did beer come on the scene?
Beer isn't brewed in England until the early 15th century. It's imported into England earlier, but it's mostly, until really well into the 15th century, it's seen as a foreign drink. And actually there's some interesting nationalistic literature about how ale is a good English drink and beer is a foreign Dutch drink that the English shouldn't drink, and so on.
So its origins, at least as far as the English were concerned, was that it came from Holland, from the Dutch?
Well, the term Dutch in that period sort of generically referred to areas that we today would call the Netherlands and Belgium, and also various German principalities.
Okay. You talk in your book a bit about the importance of beer in a political sense. Tell me a little bit about regulation, taxes, and so on.
Beer, like bread, beer and bread were regulated at the national level very, very early. There are even some regulations that date back to the Anglo-Saxon period. The critical regulation is from the 13th century. It's called the Assize of Ale and Beer, and it basically commands authorities at the local level, either manorial officials or town officials, to regulate the way in which ale and beer are sold, to make sure that it's good quality stuff, that it's sold at proper measure, and also that it's sold at reasonable prices. That regulation really operates at two levels of motivation. One is that making sure that a supply of ale and bread was always available was very important in terms of social harmony. When ale is too expensive or not available, or the same with bread, you're likely to have people in the streets causing trouble. So that's the first motivation for regulation. The second is purely physical, making money. Because the regulation of the trade generated income for whoever regulated it, because you could make brewers and also bakers pay fees to be licensed to pursue the trade.
Well, knowing the period a bit, I don't think I'd apply for the tax collecting job, but the tasting job you mentioned sounds pretty good. I might take that one.
That's right. The way local regulation operated usually is that there was an officer called an ale taster who was responsible for going round to any household that had ale to sell, and it was his job, it was always a man, to taste the ale and therefore determine how alcoholic it was and therefore determine its price and also determine whether it was healthy. It sounds like a great job, but we do have records actually about the problems ale tasters had, that they sometimes got ill from tasting the ale, and also sometimes they got into pretty nasty fights with brewers and brewsters.
Well, maybe I won't take the job after all. Now, these changes that you talk about don't take place in a vacuum. You have a larger history of transformation going on here that you talk about in your book. How does all this fit into the general scheme of history in this time period?
Hmm. Well, the transformation of brewing from the small-scale, domestic, localized industry into what it is, which is what it was really in 1300, to the way it looks in 1600, when it's a very sophisticated industry, highly capitalized, very professionalized. Really, brewing has some of the earliest, what you might call proto-factories in England. You have these huge brew houses along the Thames in London that employ dozens of people and produce huge amounts of ale or beer by the end of the 16th century. That change in brewing is, in a sense, a classic example of what we often call the commercial revolution, a more capitalized, more industrialized, more professionalized business. So in that sense, brewing is a classic example. What I argue in the book, though, is that if you look at it from the point of view of women, it suggests that although there are enormous economic and social changes happening in this period, not a great deal changes for women.
So that's
brewing changes. Okay. Women's status in the trade, I argue, doesn't change very much at all.
So that's your reference then to considerable change and yet continuities at the same time.
That's right.
Things like urbanization and rising per capita income and all of these other factors play into it strongly as well.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. For example, urbanization creates much larger markets that are much easier to reach, which means that you can brew larger amounts of ale and beer and market it much more efficiently and quickly, which again leads to a more profitable industry.
Right. You mentioned the development of alehouses as well rather quickly here, because we're getting near the end of our time. Is this where we can look to the beginnings of these kinds of social places, largely for men?
alehouses were not largely for men in the Middle Ages.
Uh-huh.
They are largely for men in the 19th century, for example. There are a lot of organizations that are largely for men, though, in the Middle Ages. So I might look to other places, for example, to the social gatherings associated with medieval trade guilds.
Okay. Let me just wind it up with and let you respond to one of your quotes here, because I found it a good one. You say that you set out to investigate, quote, what English people thought about Brewsters and how their ideas might have affected the ability of women to compete with men in the trade. It seems to me to be central to what you're writing about. How would you summarize what you found in that search?
Well, in the book I looked at a lot of sort of classic historical factors at economic change and how that affected women, and at changes in regulation and how that affected women, and so on. What I set out to do when I looked at how people thought about Brewsters was, in a sense, to think about cultural causes in terms of women leaving the trade. And what I found is that there were very, very negative associations attached to female brewers, to Brewsters, that were not attached to male brewers. And I examined those and concluded that, in fact, I think that in this case, words do hurt, and that it was one of the factors that encouraged, that harmed women insofar as they were competing with men for this trade.
This is a story we could pursue for perhaps a whole other show sometime. This is a not uncommon explanation of what happens in study of gender and history.
Yes, I think that's right. But it's very hard to nail down. You can look at things like economic changes, as I do in the book, and have tables and so on. But when you're talking about ideas, it's much harder to prove cause and effect.
Great. Well, we'll have to end it there. Thank you for joining us, Professor Bennett.
No, thank you.
You've been listening to Judith Bennett, Professor of History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and the author of Ale, Beer, and Brewsters in England, Woman's Work in a Changing World, 1300 to 1600, published by Oxford University Press.